out and laid on a trestle in an empty room adjoining the bay, and the assistant pressed an icy cloth to his nose and told him to breathe deeply. In that sleep, and in sleeps to follow, the judge did visit. Who would come other? A great shambling mutant, silent and serene. Whatever his antecedents, he was something wholly other than their sum. Nor was there system by which to divide him back into his origins, for he would not go. Whoever would seek out his history, through what unraveling of loins and ledger books, must stand at last darkened and dumb at the shore of a void without terminus or origin. And whatever science he might bring to bear upon the dusty primal matter blowing down out of the millennia, will discover no trace of any ultimate atavistic egg by which to reckon his commencing. In the white and empty room he stood in his bespoken suit, with his hat in his hand, and he peered down with his small and lashless pig's eyes, wherein this child, just 16 years on earth, could read whole bodies of decisions not accountable to the courts of men. And he saw his own name, which nowhere else could he have ciphered out at all, logged into the records as a thing already accomplished. A traveler known in jurisdictions existing only in the claims of certain pensioners or on old dated maps. In his delirium he ransacked the linens of his pallet for arms, but there were none. The judge smiled. The fool was no longer there, but another man. And this other man he could never see in his entirety, but he seemed an artisan and a worker in metal. The judge enshadowed him where he crouched at his trade, but he was a cold forger who worked with hammer and die, perhaps under some indictment, and an exile from men's fires, hammering out like his own conjectural destiny all through the night of his becoming some coinage for a dawn that would not be. It is this false moneyer, with his gravers and burins, who seeks favor with the judge, and he is contriving from cold slag, brute in the crucible, a face that will pass, an image that will render this residual specie current in the markets where men barter. Of this is the judge, judge, and the night does not end. The light in the room altered, a door closed. He opened his eyes. His leg was swathed in sheeting, and it was propped up with small rolls of reed matting. He was desperate with thirst, and his head was booming, and his leg was like an evil visitant in the bed with him, such was the pain. By and by the assistant came with water for him. He did not sleep again. The water that he drank ran out through his skin and drenched the bedding, and he lay without moving, as if to outwit the pain, and his face was gray and drawn, and his long hair damp and matted. A week more, and he was hobbling through the town on crutches provided him by the surgeon. He inquired at every door for news of the ex-priest, but no one knew him. In June of that year, he was in Los Angeles, quartered in a hostel that was no more than a common doss house, he and 40 other men of every nationality. On the morning of the 11th, all rose up still in darkness and turned out to witness a public hanging at the carcel. When he arrived, it was paling light, and already such a horde of spectators at the gate that he could not well see the proceedings. He stood at the edge of the crowd while day broke and speeches were said. Then abruptly two bound figures rose vertically from among their fellows to the top of the gatehouse, and there they hung, and there they died. Bottles were handed about, and the witnesses who had stood in silence began to talk again. In the evening, when he returned to that place, there was no one there at all. A guard leaned in the gatehouse portal chewing tobacco, and the hanged men at their rope ends looked like effigies for to frighten birds. As he drew near, he saw that it was Toadvine and Brown. He'd little money, and then he'd none. but he was in every dram house and gaming room, every cockpit and doggery. A quiet youth in a suit too large, and the same broken boots he'd come off the desert in. Standing just within the door of a foul saloon, with his eyes shifting under the brim of the hat he wore, and the light from a wall sconce on the side of his face, he was taken for a male whore, and set up to drink, and then shown to the rear of the premises. He left his patron senseless in a mud room, where there was no light. Other men found him on their own sordid missions, and other men took his purse and watch. Later still, someone took his shoes. He heard no news of the priest, and he'd quit asking. Returning to his lodgings one morning at daybreak in a gray rain, he saw a face slobbering in an upper window, and he climbed the stairwell and rapped at the door. A woman in a silk kimono opened the door and looked out at him. Behind her, in the room, a candle burned at a table, and in the pale light at the window, a halfwit sat in a pen with a cat. It turned to look at him. Not the judge's fool, but just some other fool. When the woman asked him what he wanted, he turned without speaking and descended the stairwell into the rain and the mud in the street. With his last $2, he bought from a soldier the scapular of heathen ears that Brown had worn to the scaffold. He was wearing them the next morning, when he hired out to an independent conductor from the state of Missouri, and he was wearing them when they set out for Fremont on the Sacramento River with a train of wagons and pack animals. If the conductor had any curiosity about the necklace, he kept it to himself. He was at this employment for some months, and he left it without notice. He traveled about from place to place. He didn't avoid the company of other men. He was treated with a certain deference, as one who had got on to terms with life beyond what his years could account for. By now he'd come by a horse and a revolver, the rudiments of an outfit. He worked at different trades. He had a Bible that he'd found at the mining camps, and he carried this book with him, no word of which could he read. In his dark and frugal clothes, some took him for a sort of preacher, but he was no witness to them, neither of things at hand nor things to come, he least of any man. They were remote places for news that he traveled in, and in those uncertain times men toasted the ascension of rulers already deposed, and hailed the coronation of kings murdered and in their graves. Of such corporal histories, even as these, he bore no tidings. And although it was the custom in that wilderness to stop with any traveler and exchange the news, he seemed to travel with no news at all, as if the doings of the world were too slanderous for him to truck with, or perhaps too trivial. He saw men killed with guns and with knives and with ropes, and he saw women fought over to the death whose value they themselves set at $2. He saw ships from the land of China chained in the small harbors, and bales of tea and silks and spices broken open with swords by small yellow men with speech like cats. On that lonely coast where the steep rocks cradled a dark and muttersome sea, he saw vultures at their soaring whose wingspans so dwarfed all lesser birds that the eagles shrieking underneath were more like terns or plovers. He saw piles of gold a hat would scarcely have covered, wagered on the turn of a card and lost. And he saw bears and lions turned loose in pits to fight wild bulls to the death. And he was twice in the city of San Francisco and twice saw it burn and never went back, riding out on horseback along the road to the south where all night the shape of the city burned against the sky and burned again in the black waters of the sea where dolphins rolled through the flames, fire in the lake, through the fall of burning timbers and the cries of the lost. He never saw the ex-priest again. Of the judge, he heard rumor everywhere. In the spring of his 28th year, he set out with others upon the desert to the east, he, one of five at hire, to see a party through the wilderness to their homes halfway across the continent. 7 days from the coast at a desert well, he left them. They were just a band of pilgrims returning to their homes, men and women already dusty and travel-worn. He set the horse's face north toward the stone mountains, running thinly under the edge of the sky, and he rode the stars down and the sun up. It was no country he had ever seen, and there was no track to follow into those mountains, and there was no track out. Yet in the deepest fastness of those rocks, he met with men who seemed unable to abide the silence of the world. He first saw them laboring over the plain in the dusk, among flowering ocotillo that burned in the final light like horned candelabra. They were led by a pitero, piping a reed, and then in procession a clanging of tambourines and matracas, and men naked to the waist in black capes and hoods, who flailed themselves with whips of braided yuca, and men who bore on their naked backs great loads of chola, and a man tied to a rope who was pulled this way and that by his companions, and a hooded man in a white robe who bore a heavy wooden cross on his shoulders. They were, all of them, barefoot, and they left a trail of blood across the rocks, and they were followed by a rude carreta, in which sat a carved wooden skeleton who rattled along stiffly, holding before him a bow and arrow. He shared his cart with a load of stones, and they went trundling over the rocks, drawn by ropes tied to the heads and ankles of the bearers, and accompanied by a deputation of women, who carried small desert flowers in their folded hands, or torches of sotal, or primitive lanterns of pierced tin. This troubled sect traversed slowly the ground under the bluff where the watchers stood, and made their way over the broken scree of a fan washed out of the draw above them, and wailing and piping and clanging, they passed between the granite walls into the upper valley, and disappeared in the coming darkness like heralds of some unspeakable calamity, leaving only bloody footprints on the stone. He bivouacked in a barren swale, and he and the horse lay down together, and all night the dry wind blew down the desert, and the wind was all but silent, for there was nothing of resonance among those rocks. In the dawn he and the horse stood watching the east where the light commenced, and then he saddled the horse and led it down a scrabbled trail through a canyon where he found a tank deep under a pitch of boulders. The water lay in darkness, and the stones were cool, and he drank and fetched water for the horse in his hat. Then he led the animal up onto the ridge, and they went on, the man watching the tableland to the south and the mountains to the north, and the horse clattering along behind. By and by the horse began to toss its head, and soon it would not go. He stood holding the hackamore and studying the country. Then he saw the pilgrims. They were scattered about below him in a stone coulee, dead in their blood. He took down his rifle and squatted and listened. He led the horse under the shade of the rock wall and hobbled it and moved along the rock and down the slope. The company of penitents lay hacked and butchered among the stones in every attitude. Many lay about the fallen cross, and some were mutilated, and some were without heads. Perhaps they'd gathered under the cross for shelter, but the hole into which it had been set, and the cairn of rocks about its base, showed how it had been pushed over, and how the hooded altar Christ had been cut down and disemboweled, who now lay with the scraps of rope by which he had been bound still tied about his wrists and ankles. The kid rose and looked about at this desolate scene, and then he saw, alone and upright in a small niche in the rocks, an old woman kneeling in a faded rebozo, with her eyes cast down. He made his way among the corpses and stood before her. She was very old, and her face was gray and leathery, and sand had collected in the folds of her clothing. She did not look up. The shawl that covered her head was much faded of its color, yet it bore, like a patent woven into the fabric, the figures of stars and quarter moons and other insignia of a providence unknown to him. He spoke to her in a low voice. He told her that he was an American, and that he was a long way from the country of his birth, and that he had no family, and that he had traveled much and seen many things, and had been at war and endured hardships. He told her that he would convey her to a safe place, some party of her country people, who would welcome her, and that she should join them, for he could not leave her in this place, or she would surely die. He knelt on one knee, resting the rifle before him like a staff.
"Abuelita," he said, "no puedes escucharme?"
He reached into the little cove and touched her arm. She moved slightly, her whole body, light and rigid. She weighed nothing. She was just a dried shell, and she had been dead in that place for years. Chapter 23. On the North Texas Plains, an old buffalo hunter, the millennial herds, the bone pickers, night on the prairie, the callers, Apache ears, Elrod takes a stand, a killing, bearing off the dead, Fort Griffin, the beehive, a stage show, the judge, killing a bear. The judge speaks of old times, in preparation for the dance. The judge on war, destiny, the supremacy of man. The dance hall, the whore, the Jakes and what was encountered there. Sie müssen schlafen, aber ich muss tanzen. In the late winter of 1878, he was on the plains of North Texas. He crossed the double mountain fork of the Brazos River on a morning when skim ice lay along the sandy shore, and he rode through a dark dwarf forest of black and twisted mesquite trees. He made his camp that night on a piece of high ground where there was a windbreak formed of a tree felled by lightning. He'd no sooner got his fire to burn than he saw across the prairie in the darkness another fire. Like his, it twisted in the wind. Like his, it warmed one man alone. It was an old hunter in camp, and the hunter shared tobacco with him, and told him of the buffalo, and the stands he'd made against them, laid up in a sag on some rise with the dead animals scattered over the grounds, and the herd beginning to mill, and the rifle barrel so hot the wiping patches sizzled in the bore, and the animals by the thousands and tens of thousands, and the hides pegged out over actual square miles of ground, and the teams of skinners spelling one another around the clock, and the shooting and shooting weeks and months, till the boar shot slick, and the stock shot loose at the tang, and their shoulders were yellow and blue to the elbow, and the tandem wagons groaned away over the prairie 20 and 22 ox teams, and the flint hides by the ton and hundred ton, and the meat rotting on the ground, and the air whining with flies, and the buzzards and ravens, and the night a horror of snarling and feeding, with the wolves half-crazed and wallowing in the carrion. I seen Studebaker wagons with 6 and 8 ox teams headed out for the grounds, not hauling a thing but lead. Just pure galena. Tons of it. On this ground alone, between the Arkansas River and the Concho there, was 8 million carcasses, for that's how many hides reach the railhead. 2 year ago, we pulled out from Griffin for a last hunt. We ransacked the country. 6 weeks. Finally found a herd of 8 animals, and we killed them and come in. They're gone. Every one of them that God ever made is gone, as if they'd never been at all. The ragged sparks blew down the wind. The prairie about them lay silent. Beyond the fire it was cold, and the night was clear, and the stars were falling. The old hunter pulled his blanket about him. "I wonder if there's other worlds like this," he said, "or if this is the only one." When he came upon the bone pickers, he'd been riding 3 days in a country he'd never seen. The plains were sere and burnt-looking, and the small trees black and misshapen, and haunted by ravens, and everywhere the ragged packs of jackal wolves, and the crazed and sun-chalked bones of the vanished herds. He dismounted and led the horse. Here and there within the arc of ribs a few flat disks of darkened lead, like old medallions of some order of the hunt. In the distance, teams of oxen bore along slowly, and the heavy wagons creaked dryly. Into these barrows the pickers tossed the bones, kicking down the calcined architecture, breaking apart the great frames with axes. The bones clattered in the wagons. They plowed on in the pale dust. He watched them pass, ragged, filthy, the oxen galled and mad-looking. None spoke to him. In the distance he could see a train of wagons moving off to the northeast with great tottering loads of bones, and further to the north other teams of pickers at their work. He mounted and rode on. The bones had been gathered into windrows 10 feet high and hundreds long, or into great conical hills topped with the signs or brands of their owners. He overtook one of the lumbering carts, a boy riding the near-wheel ox and driving with a jerkline and a jockey stick. Two youths squatting atop a mound of skulls and pelvic bones leered down at him. Their fires dotted the plain that night, and he sat with his back to the wind and drank from an army canteen and ate a handful of parched corn for his supper. All across those reaches the yammer and yap of the starving wolves relayed, and to the north the silent lightning rigged a broken lyre upon the world's dark rim. The air smelled of rain, but no rain fell, and the creaking bone carts passed in the night like darkened ships, and he could smell the oxen and hear their breath. The sour smell of the bones was everywhere. Toward midnight a party hailed him as he squatted at his coals. "Come up," he said. They came up out of the dark, sullen wretches dressed in skins. They carried old military guns, save for one who had a buffalo rifle, and they had no coats, and one of them wore green hide boots peeled whole from the hocks of some animal, and the toes gathered shut with leader.
"Evening, stranger,"
called out the eldest child among them. He looked at them. They were four and a half-grown boy, and they halted at the edge of the light and arranged themselves there. "Come up," he said. They shuffled forward. Three of them squatted and two stood.
"Where's your outfit?" said one. "He ain't out for bones. You ain't got nary chew tobacco about your clothes, have you?"
He shook his head.
"Nary drink of whiskey, neither, I don't reckon. He ain't got no whiskey. Where you headed, mister?
Are you headed towards Griffin?" He looked them over. "I am," he said.
"Going for the whores, I bet you." "He ain't going for the whores. It's full of whores, Griffin is. Hell, he's probably been there more than you. You been to Griffin, mister?"
"Not yet."
"Full of whores. Full plumb up. They say you can get clapped a day's ride out when the wind is right. They sit in a tree in front of this here place, and you can look up and see their bloomers. I counted high as 8 in that tree early of an evening. Sit up there like coons and smoke cigarettes and holler down at you. It's set up to be the biggest town for sin in all Texas. It's as lively a place for murderers as you'd care to visit. Scrapes with knives, about any kind of meanness you can name."
He looked at them from one to the other. He reached and took up a stick and roused the fire with it and put the stick in the flames.
"You all like meanness?" he said. "We don't hold with it."
"Like to drink whiskey?"
"He's just talking. He ain't no whiskey drinker. Hell, you just now seen him drink it, not an hour ago. I seen him puke it back up, too. What's them things around your neck there, mister?"
He pulled the aged scapular from his shirt front and looked at it.
"It's ears,"
he said.
His what?
Ears.
What kind of ears?
He tugged at the thong and looked down at them. They were perfectly black and hard and dry and of no shape at all. Humans, he said. Human ears.
Ain't done it,
said the one with the rifle.
Don't you call him a liar, Elrod. He's liable to shoot you. Let's see them things, mister, if you don't care.
He slipped the scapular over his head and handed it across to the boy who'd spoken. They pressed about and felt the strange, dried pendants.
Niggers, ain't it?
They said.
Dock them niggers' ears so they know 'em when they run off. How many is there, mister?
I don't know. Used to be near 100. They held the thing up and turned it in the firelight.
Nigger ears, by God!
They ain't niggers.
They ain't?
No.
What are they?
Injuns.
The hell they are. Elrod, you done been told. How come them to be so black as that if they ain't niggers?
They turned that way. They got blacker till they couldn't black no more.
Where'd you get them at? Killed them sons of bitches, didn't you, mister? You been a scout on the prairies, ain't you?
I bought them ears in California off a soldier in a saloon, didn't have no money to drink on. He reached and took the scapular from them.
Shoot, I bet he's been a scout on the prairie, killed every one of them sons of bitches.
The one called Elrod followed the trophies with his chin and sniffed the air.
I don't see what you want with them things, he said. I wouldn't have them.
The others looked at him uneasily.
You don't know where them ears come from. That old boy you bought them off might have said they was Injuns, but that don't make it so.
The man didn't answer.
Them ears could have come off of cannibals or any other kind of foreign nigger. They tell me you can buy the whole heads in New Orleans. Sailors brings them in, and you can buy them for $5 all day long, them heads. Hush, Elrod.
The man sat holding the necklace in his hands. They wasn't cannibals, he said. They was Apaches. I knowed the man that docked them. Knowed him and rode with him and seen him hung. Elrod looked at the others and grinned.
Apaches, he said. I bet them old Apaches would give a watermelon a pure fit. What about you all?
The man looked up wearily.
You ain't calling me a liar, are you, son?
I ain't, you son.
How old are you?
That's some more of your business.
How old are you?
He's 15. You hush your damn mouth.
He turned to the man.
He don't speak for me, he said.
He's done spoke. I was 15 year old when I was first shot.
I ain't never been shot.
You ain't 16 yet, neither.
You aim to shoot me?
I aim to try to keep from it.
Come on, Elrod. You ain't gonna shoot nobody. Maybe in the back or them asleep. Elrod, we're gone. I knowed you for what you was when I seen you.
You better go on.
Sit there and talk about shooting somebody. They ain't nobody done it yet.
The other four stood at the limits of the firelight. The youngest of them was casting glances out at the dark sanctuary of the prairie night.
Go on, the man said. They're waiting on you.
He spat into the man's fire and wiped his mouth. Out on the prairie to the north, a train of yoked wagons was passing, and the oxen were pale and silent in the starlight, and the wagons creaked faintly in the distance, and a lantern with a red glass followed them out like an alien eye. This country was filled with violent children, orphaned by war. His companions had started back to fetch him, and perhaps this emboldened him the more, and perhaps he said other things to the man, for when they got to the fire, the man had risen to his feet.
"You keep him away from me," he said. "I see him back here, I'll kill him."
When they had gone, he built up the fire, and caught the horse and took the hobbles off and tied it and saddled it, and then he moved off apart and spread his blanket and lay down in the dark. When he woke, there was still no light in the east. The boy was standing by the ashes of the fire with the rifle in his hand. The horse had snuffed, and now it snuffed again.
"I knowed you'd be hit out," the boy called.
He pushed back the blanket and rolled onto his stomach and cocked the pistol and leveled it at the sky where the clustered stars were burning for eternity. He centered the foresight in the milled groove of the frame strap, and holding the piece so, he swung it through the dark of the trees with both hands to the darker shape of the visitor. "I'm right here," he said. The boy swung with a rifle and fired. "You wouldn't have lived anyway," the man said. It was gray dawn when the others came up. They had no horses. They led the half-grown boy to where the dead youth was lying on his back with his hands composed upon his chest.
"We don't want no trouble, mister. We just want to take him with us."
"Take him."
"I knowed we'd bury him on this prairie. They come out here from Kentucky, mister. This Tyke and his brother. His mama and daddy both dead. His granddaddy was killed by a lunatic and buried in the woods like a dog. He's never known good fortune in his life, and now he ain't got a soul in this world. Randall, you take a good look at the man that has made you an orphan."
The orphan, in his large clothes, holding the old musket with the mended stock, stared at him woodenly. He was maybe 12 years old, and he looked not so much dull-witted as insane. Two of the others were going through the dead boy's pockets.
"Where's his rifle at, mister?"
The man stood with his hand on his belt. He nodded to where the rifle stood against a tree. They brought it over and presented it to the brother. It was a Sharps 50 caliber, and holding it and the musket, he stood inanely armed, his eyes skittering. One of the older boys handed him the dead boy's hat, and then he turned to the man.
"He give $40 for that rifle in Little Rock. You can buy him in Griffin for 10. They ain't worth nothing. Randall, you ready to go?"
He did not assist as a bearer, for he was too small. When they set out across the prairie with his brother's body carried up on their shoulders, he followed behind carrying the musket and the dead boy's rifle and the dead boy's hat. The man watched them go. Out there was nothing. They were simply bearing the body off over the bone-strewn waste toward a naked horizon. The orphan turned once to look back at him, and then he hurried to catch up. In the afternoon, he rode through the Mackenzie crossing of the Clear Fork of the Brazos River, and he and the horse walked side by side down the twilight toward the town, where in the long red dusk and in the darkness the random aggregate of the lamps formed slowly a false shore of hospice, cradled on the low plain before them. They passed enormous ricks of bones, colossal dikes composed of horned skulls and the crescent ribs, like old ivory bows heaped in the aftermath of some legendary battle, great levees of them curving away over the plain into the night. They entered the town in a light rain falling. The horse nickered and snuffed shyly at the hocks of the other animals standing at stall before the lamp-lit banyos they passed. Fiddle music issued into the solitary mud street, and lean dogs crossed before them from shadow to shadow. At the end of the town, he led the horse to a rail, and tied it among the others, and stepped up the low wooden stairs into the dim light that fell from the doorway there. He looked back a last time at the street, and at the random window lights let into the darkness, and at the last pale light in the west and the low dark hills around. Then he pushed open the door and entered. A dimly seething rabble had coagulated within. as if the raw board structure erected for their containment occupied some ultimate sink into which they had gravitated from off the surrounding flatlands. An old man in a Tyrolean costume was shuffling among the rough tables with his hat outheld, while a little girl in a smock cranked a barrel organ, and a bear in a crinoline twirled strangely upon a board stage defined by a row of tallow candles that dripped and sputtered in their pools of grease. He made his way through the crowd to the bar, where several men in gaitered shirts were drawing beer or pouring whiskey. Young boys worked behind them, fetching crates of bottles and racks of glasses steaming from the scullery to the rear. The bar was covered with zinc, and he placed his elbows upon it and spun a silver coin before him and slapped it flat.
"Speak or forever," said the barman.
"A whiskey."
"Whiskey it is."
He set up a glass and uncorked a bottle and poured perhaps half a gill and took the coin. He stood looking at the whiskey. Then he took his hat off and placed it on the bar and took up the glass and drank it very deliberately and set the empty glass down again. He wiped his mouth and turned around and placed his elbows on the bar behind him. Watching him across the layered smoke in the yellow light was the judge. He was sitting at one of the tables. He wore a round hat with a narrow brim, and he was among every kind of man, herder and bullwhacker and drover and freighter and miner and hunter and soldier and peddler and gambler and drifter and drunkard and thief. And he was among the dregs of the earth in beggary 1,000 years, and he was among the scapegrace scions of eastern dynasties. And in all that motley assemblage, he sat by them and yet alone, as if he were some other sort of man entire, and he seemed little changed or none in all these years. He turned away from those eyes and stood looking down at the empty tumbler between his fists. When he looked up, the barman was watching him. He raised his forefinger, and the barman brought the whiskey. He paid, he lifted the glass, and drank. There was a mirror along the back bar, but it held only smoke and phantoms. The barrel organ was groaning and creaking, and the bear, with tongue alol, was revolving heavily on the boards. When he turned, the judge had risen and was speaking with other men. The showman made his way through the throng, shaking the coins in his hat. Garishly clad whores were going out through a door at the rear of the premises, and he watched them, and he watched the bear. And when he looked back across the room, the judge wasn't there. The showman seemed to be in altercation with the man standing at the table. Another man rose. The showman gestured with his hat. One of them pointed toward the bar. He shook his head. Their voices were incoherent in the din. On the boards, the bear was dancing for all that his heart was worth, and the girl cranked the organ handle, and the shadow of the act which the candlelight constructed upon the wall might have gone begging for reference in any daylight world. When he looked back, the showman had donned the hat, and he stood with his hands on his hips. One of the men had drawn a long-barreled cavalry pistol from his belt. He turned and leveled the pistol toward the stage. Some dove for the floor. Some reached for their own arms. The owner of the bear stood like a pitchman at a shooting gallery. The shot was thunderous, and in the afterclap, all sound in that room ceased. The bear had been shot through the midsection. He let out a low moan, and he began to dance faster, dancing in silence save for the slap of his great footpads on the planks. Blood was running down his groin. The little girl strapped into the barrel organ stood frozen, the crank at rest on the upswing. The man with the pistol fired again, and the pistol bucked and roared, and the black smoke rolled, and the bear groaned and began to reel drunkenly. He was holding his chest, and a thin foam of blood swung from his jaw, and he began to totter and to cry like a child. And he took a few last steps, dancing, and crashed to the boards. Someone had seized the pistol arm of the man who'd done the shooting, and the gun was waving aloft. The owner of the bear stood stunned, clutching the brim of his old-world hat.
"Shot the goddamn bear!" said the barman.
The little girl had unbuckled herself out of the barrel organ, and it clattered wheezing to the floor. She ran forward and knelt and gathered the great shaggy head up in her arms and began to rock back and forth, sobbing. Most of the men in the room had risen, and they stood in the smoky yellow space with their hands on their sidearms. Whole flocks of horrors were scuttling toward the rear, and a woman mounted to the boards and stepped past the bear and held out her hands.
"It's all over," she said. "It's all over."
"Do you believe it's all over, son?"
He turned. The judge was standing at the bar looking down at him. He smiled. He removed his hat. The great pale dome of his skull shone like an enormous phosphorescent egg in the lamplight.
"The last of the true. The last of the true. I'd say they're all gone under now, saving me and thee, would you not?"
He tried to see past him. That great corpus enshadowed him from all beyond. He could hear the woman announcing the commencement of dancing in the hall to the rear.
"And some are not yet born who shall have cause to curse the Dauphin's soul," said the judge.
He turned slightly.
"Plenty of time for the dance."
"I ain't studying no dance."
The judge smiled. The Tyrolean and another man were bent over the bear. The girl was sobbing, the front of her dress dark with blood. The judge leaned across the bar and seized a bottle and snapped the cork out of it with his thumb. The cork whined off into the blackness above the lamps like a bullet. He rifled a great drink down his throat and leaned back against the bar.
"You're here for the dance," he said.
"I got to go."
The judge looked aggrieved.
"Go?" he said.
He nodded. He reached and took hold of his hat where it lay on the bar, but he didn't take it up, and he didn't move.
"What man would not be a dancer if he could?" said the judge. "It's a great thing, the dance."
The woman was kneeling and had her arm around the little girl. The candles sputtered, and the great hairy mound of the bear, dead in its crinoline, lay like some monster slain in the commission of unnatural acts. The judge poured the tumbler full where it stood empty alongside the hat and nudged it forward.
"Drink up," he said. "Drink up. This night thy soul may be required of thee."
He looked at the glass. The judge smiled and gestured with the bottle. He took up the glass and drank. The judge watched him.
"Was it always your idea," he said, "that if you did not speak, you would not be recognized?"
"You see me."
The judge ignored this.
"I recognized you when I first saw you, and yet you were a disappointment to me, then and now. Even so, at the last, I find you here with me."
"I ain't with you."
The judge raised his bald brow.
"Not?" he said.
He looked about him in a puzzled and artful way, and he was a passable thespian.
"I never come here hunting you."
"What then?" said the judge.
"What would I want with you? I come here same reason as any man."
"And what reason is that?"
"What reason is what?"
"That these men are here.
They come here to have a good time."
The judge watched him. He began to point out various men in the room, and to ask if these men were here for a good time, or if indeed they knew why they were here at all.
"Everybody don't have to have a reason to be someplace."
"That's so," said the judge.
"They do not have to have a reason. But order is not set aside because of their indifference. He regarded the judge warily. Let me put it this way, said the judge. If it is so that they themselves have no reason, and yet are indeed here, must they not be here by reason of some other? And if this is so, can you guess who that other might be? No. Can you? I know him well. He poured the tumbler full once more, and he took a drink himself from the bottle, and he wiped his mouth and turned to regard the room. This is an orchestration for an event. For a dance, in fact. The participants will be apprised of their roles at the proper time. For now, it is enough that they have arrived. As the dance is the thing with which we are concerned and contains complete within itself its own arrangement and history and finale, there is no necessity that the dancers contain these things within themselves as well. In any event, the history of all is not the history of each, nor indeed the sum of those histories. And none here can finally comprehend the reason for his presence, for he has no way of knowing even in what the event consists. In fact, were he to know, he might well absent himself. And you can see that that cannot be any part of the plan, if plan there be. He smiled. His great teeth shone. He drank. An event, a ceremony, the orchestration thereof. The overture carries certain marks of decisiveness. It includes the slaying of a large bear. The evening's progress will not appear strange or unusual, even to those who question the rightness of the events so ordered. A ceremony, then. One could well argue that there are not categories of no ceremony, but only ceremonies of greater or lesser degree. And deferring to this argument, we will say that this is a ceremony of a certain magnitude, perhaps more commonly called a ritual. A ritual includes the letting of blood. Rituals which fail in this requirement are but mock rituals. Here, every man knows the false at once, never doubt it. That feeling in the breast that evokes a child's memory of loneliness, such as when the others have gone and only the game is left with its solitary participant. A solitary game without opponent, where only the rules are at hazard. Don't look away. We're not speaking in mysteries. You of all men are no stranger to that feeling, the emptiness and the despair. It is that which we take arms against, is it not? Is not blood the tempering agent and the mortar which bonds? The judge leaned closer. What do you think death is, man? Of whom do we speak when we speak of a man who was and is not? Are these blind riddles, or are they not some part of every man's jurisdiction? What is death if not an agency? And whom does he intend toward? Look at me.
I don't like craziness.
Nor I. Bear with me. Look at them now. Pick a man, any man. That man there, see him? That man, hatless. You know his opinion of the world. You can read it in his face, in his stance. Yet his complaint that a man's life is no bargain masks the actual case with him, which is that men will not do as he wishes them to, have never done, never will do. That's the way of things with him, and his life is so balked about by difficulty and becomes so altered of its intended architecture that he is little more than a walking hovel, hardly fit to house the human spirit at all. Can he say, such a man, that there is no malign thing set against him? That there is no power and no force and no cause? What manner of heretic could doubt agency and claimant alike? Can he believe that the wreckage of his existence is unentailed?
no liens, no creditors, that gods of vengeance and of compassion alike lie sleeping in their crypt, and whether our cries are for an accounting or for the destruction of the ledgers altogether, they must evoke only the same silence, and that it is this silence which will prevail. To whom is he talking, man? Can't you see him? The man was indeed muttering to himself, and peering balefully about the room, wherein it seemed there was no friend to him. A man seeks his own destiny and no other, said the judge. Will or nill? Any man who could discover his own fate and elect, therefore, some opposite course could only come at last to that selfsame reckoning at the same appointed time. For each man's destiny is as large as the world he inhabits, and contains within it all opposites as well. This desert upon which so many have been broken is vast, and calls for largeness of heart. But it is also, ultimately, empty. It is hard, it is barren. Its very nature is stone. He poured the tumbler full. Drink up, he said. The world goes on. We have dancing nightly, and this night is no exception. The straight and the winding way are one, and now that you are here, what do the years count since last we two met together? Men's memories are uncertain, and the past that was differs little from the past that was not. He took up the tumbler the judge had poured, and he drank, and set it down again. He looked at the judge. I've been everywhere, he said. This is just one more place. The judge arched his brow. Did you post witnesses? He said. To report to you on the continuing existence of those places once you'd quit them?
That's crazy.
Is it? Where is yesterday? Where is Glanton and Brown, and where is the priest? He leaned closer. Where is Shelby, whom you left to the mercies of Elias in the desert? And where is Tate, whom you abandoned in the mountains? Where are the ladies, the fair and tender ladies, with whom you danced at the governor's ball when you were a hero, anointed with the blood of the enemies of the republic you'd elected to defend? And where is the fiddler, and where the dance?
I guess you can tell me.
I tell you this. As war becomes dishonored and its nobility called into question, those honorable men who recognize the sanctity of blood will become excluded from the dance, which is the warrior's right. And thereby will the dance become a false dance, and the dancers false dancers. And yet there will be one there always who is a true dancer. And can you guess who that might be?
You ain't nothing.
You speak truer than you know. But I will tell you. Only that man who has offered himself entire to the blood of war, who has been to the floor of the pit and seen horror in the round, and learned at last that it speaks to his inmost heart, only that man can dance.
Even a dumb animal can dance.
The judge set the bottle on the bar. Hear me, man, he said. There is room on the stage for one beast and one alone. All others are destined for a night that is eternal and without name. One by one they will step down into the darkness before the footlamps. Bears that dance, bears that don't. He drifted with the crowd toward the door at the rear. In the anteroom sat men at cards, dim in the smoke. He moved on. A woman was taking chits from the men as they passed through to the shed at the rear of the building. She looked up at him. He had no chit. She directed him to a table where a woman was selling the chits and stuffing the money with a piece of shingle through a narrow slit into an iron strongbox.
He paid his dollar and took the stamped brass token and rendered it up at the door and passed through. He found himself in a large hall, with a platform for the musicians at one end and a large homemade sheet-iron stove at the other. Whole squadrons of whores were working the floor. In their stained peignoirs, in their green stockings and melon-colored drawers, they drifted through the smoky oil light like make-believe wantons, at once childlike and lewd. A dark little dwarf of a whore took his arm and smiled up at him.
"I seen you right away," she said. "I always pick the one I want."
She led him through a door where an old Mexican woman was handing out towels and candles, and they ascended like refugees of some sordid disaster the darkened, plank-board stairwell to the upper rooms. Lying in the little cubicle with his trousers about his knees, he watched her. He watched her take up her clothes and don them, and he watched her hold the candle to the mirror and study her face there. She turned and looked at him.
"Let's go," she said. "I got to go."
"Go on."
"You can't lay there. Come on, I got to go."
He sat up and swung his legs over the edge of the little iron cot and stood and pulled his trousers up and buttoned them and buckled his belt. His hat was on the floor, and he picked it up and slapped it against the side of his leg and put it on.
"You need to get down there and get you a drink," she said. "You'll be all right."
"I'm all right now." He went out. He turned at the end of the hallway and looked back. Then he went down the stairs. She had come to the door. She stood in the hallway holding the candle and brushing her hair back with one hand. And she watched him descend into the dark of the stairwell, and then she pulled the door shut behind her. He stood at the edge of the dance floor. A ring of people had taken the floor and were holding hands and grinning and calling out to one another. A fiddler sat on a stool on the stage, and a man walked up and down calling out the order of the dance and gesturing and stepping in the way he wished them to go. Outside in the darkened lot, groups of wretched Tonkawas stood in the mud, with their faces composed in strange lost portraits within the sashwork of the window lights. The fiddler rose and set the fiddle to his jaw. There was a shout and the music began, and the ring of dancers began to rotate ponderously with a great shuffling. He went out the back. The rain had stopped and the air was cold. He stood in the yard. Stars were falling across the sky, myriad and random, speeding along brief vectors from their origins in night to their destinies in dust and nothingness. Within the hall, the fiddle squealed and the dancers shuffled and stomped. In the street, men were calling for the little girl whose bear was dead, for she was lost. They went among the darkened lots with lanterns and torches calling out to her. He went down the walkboard toward the Jakes. He stood outside listening to the voices fading away, and he looked again at the silent tracks of the stars where they died over the darkened hills. Then he opened the rough board door of the Jakes and stepped in. The judge was seated upon the closet. He was naked, and he rose up smiling, and gathered him in his arms against his immense and terrible flesh, and shot the wooden bar latch home behind him. In the saloon, two men who wanted to buy the hide were looking for the owner of the bear. The bear lay on the stage in an immense pool of blood. All the candles had gone out save one, and it guttered uneasily in its grease like a votive lamp. In the dance hall, a young man had joined the fiddler, and he kept the measure of the music with a pair of spoons, which he clapped between his knees. The whores sashayed half-naked, some with their breasts exposed. In the mudded dogyard behind the premises, two men went down the boards toward the Jakes. A third man was standing there, urinating into the mud.
"There's someone in there," the first man said.
The man who was relieving himself didn't look up.
I wouldn't go in there if I was you, he said. Is there somebody in there? I wouldn't go in.
He hitched himself up and buttoned his trousers and stepped past them,